5 in Chatham.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld heads for Moscow tomorrow. Could the anti-ballistic missile treaty be on its way out as the U.S. and Russia team up against terror? But first, breaking news this evening of a terrorist threat against bridges in California. Governor Gray Davis says today that he had received credible information that major bridges in the state, including the Golden Gate Bridge, could be targeted for attack. I'm joined now by Carrie Kahn. She's news editor at KQED in San Francisco. Hello, Carrie. What can you tell us about what the governor had to say today?
Well, the governor made the announcement at a press conference in Los Angeles. He was actually there to appoint and announce the state's new terrorism security advisor. And I think he out-trumped himself on this news. He also made the mention that he had received from several different law enforcement agencies credible threats that between November 2nd and November 7th at rush hour, there will be an effort to blow up one of the four suspension bridges in California.
Those being the Golden Gate and which others?
The Golden Gate Bridge is probably the most famous. Also in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's the Bay Bridge, which is one of the busiest bridges in the world that connects San Francisco and Oakland. And there are two suspension bridges in Southern California, one at the Port of Los Angeles and one in San Diego.
Did Governor Gray Davis give any details about the specific source of this threat?
He didn't. Well, he was pretty specific in his comments that this would happen between November 2nd and 7th at rush hour and that there would be an effort to blow up one of the bridges. Beyond that, he would not say what the source was. We heard that it came to the federal authorities. And then he also said that other law enforcement authorities had told him that. But he believed it to be credible.
Was there any indication that this might be the threat that Attorney General John Ashcroft has warned the nation of as being looming this week?
That is unclear. There was, following the governor's press conference about an hour later, there was a telephone conference call with the commissioner of the California Highway Patrol, who said he did not believe that to be the same threat. He did not know. So that's unclear. But during that same conference call, I did want to add that the commissioner of the California Highway Patrol seemed to contradict the governor a bit. He said that the threat was made to any suspension bridge in the western United States and that there was no mention that there would be something blown up and that also there was no specific date or time. He seemed to backtrack a bit from the governor's very specific statements.
But he broadened the scope of the potential threat but then made it less clear whether it meant an explosion or something else?
He definitely broadened it, and it was not just about California. It was about suspension bridges in the western United States. And he said that he did not know that it was that specific, and he didn't mean to contradict the governor, but he had been given the same information from the same federal authorities and did not believe it to be that specific.
But Governor Gray Davis was much more specific. What's the potential impact in California of this kind of explicit warning about bridges that thousands and thousands of commuters use every day to go to work?
Well, it's quite puzzling that the governor would be so specific. We've heard these warnings of heightened security at least two or three times since the September 11th events, but nobody has been this specific. He says that he made it this specific because he wants the terrorists to know that we are prepared, we know what you are up to, and we are ready. The best preparation is to let them know that, and that is why he made this known as he did.
So will the bridges be closed or just monitored closely?
The commissioner of the California Highway Patrol says there has already been extensive step-up enforcement on the bridges. He does not plan any more. There will be no spot checks of trucks or cars. The only increased surveillance will be National Guard soldiers at each point of the bridges. So if you do the math, that means there are four suspension bridges in California. There will be eight soldiers on each of the bridges. He says he feels perfectly safe driving across these bridges and that there is no need to do any sort of spot inspections, and most definitely they will not be closed.
Well, once again, we get this combination of very specific threat but then assurance that everything's okay. What's the reaction been in California? Are people planning to drive and use the bridges or not?
Well, this information was just given an hour ago. We had a reporter out on the Golden Gate Bridge immediately talking to tourists, and it was news to them. I think there has been a sense of insecurity going over these bridges, especially if you travel over some of these long suspension bridges. I travel over the Bay Bridge every day, and it's in the back of your mind. But you do see the stepped-up security. There is more California Highway Patrol officers there, and the commissioner himself said he cannot guarantee that nothing will happen. He couldn't guarantee that a plane would crash into the World Trade Center, so he cannot guarantee that nothing will happen. But they have taken all the precautions that they can and that they feel perfectly safe.
Carrie, thanks for joining us this evening.
Sure, thank you.
Carrie Kahn is news editor for KQED in San Francisco. Now, the legislative battle over the airline security bill. In about an hour, the U.S. House of Representatives is expected to vote on a package that would allow pilots to carry guns, would strengthen cockpit doors, and would deploy more sky marshals. Peter Cohn has been tracking the bill for the Congressional Quarterly. I spoke to him earlier today about the House Republicans' resistance to the Senate version of the bill, which would make 28,000 airport baggage screeners federal employees.
The Republicans, as you know, are devoted to limiting government and smaller government and downsizing bureaucracies. So the way they look at it is having 30,000 new federal employees manning screening stations at the airports would be an unacceptable expansion of government, not to mention they might be bringing in 30,000 new Democratic voters and union contributors.
But isn't this an odd place for an ideological battle for smaller government? Is that really what this is all about?
Well, the Republicans will tell you, and they do have a legitimate argument in the fact that a lot of European countries that have very tight security, as well as Israel, they do have a mix of public-private employees, although the Democrats will split hairs on that note, saying that a lot of these European countries and Israel, they have much higher trained employees and better educated and much better benefits, which contributes to much less turnover than you have here in the States.
So how much pressure is there from the House Republican leadership and the White House to vote the party line?
They're feeling tremendous amount of pressure, Tom. The White House has been bringing in groups of about a dozen or more Republicans. In fact, this morning it was close to 20 Republicans they brought over to the White House to try and do a little last-minute arm-twisting. The Democrats, a few of the more conservative members, also were brought in a couple of days ago, although it looks like their ranks are pretty much going to hold.
How strong can the lobbyists for the private security companies be in this instance? I mean, the money here is not that big, is it? We're not talking about the automobile industry or Microsoft.
No, not at all. But they've done a great job at pulling on the heartstrings of some of the more conservative Republicans, and the fact that these are, you know, that it is private industry, these are small companies, and, you know, that they should be allowed to thrive. And they've also gotten a boost in this case, the private security companies. They've gotten a boost in the fact that a lot of their employees are members of an AFL-CIO member union, the Service Employees International Union. So you have this sort of alliance between a small private industry and one of the largest unions in the country on this.
And how close does the vote look to be tonight?
I would say it's too close to call, although both sides are claiming victory. Both sides are claiming it's going to be, you know, in the 1-2 vote margin here. And I really couldn't call it at this point. It's really going to come down to the wire. It'll be exactly like that economic stimulus bill that passed last week by 2 votes, I think.
The Senate voted October 11th to make these airport screeners federal employees. The president has said that if the House votes like the Senate, he won't veto the bill.
Right.
But the White House has been very, very forceful in pushing for this more private security company version.
Yes. The fact that the White House has indicated he will not veto the bill, that really has undercut the Republican argument on this. But the fact is, President Bush does strongly support the House Republican-backed plan. He really has, only in the last couple of days, in fact, really stepped up the lobbying activity. And it really has, it's done wonders. It's really peeled away a number of Republicans who were on the fence.
House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt has said that their amendments have been attached. He calls them a goodie bag of riders for special interest. What's in those riders?
Well, there's no question about that. Even the Republican aides say privately that these are, in fact, sweeteners for wavering members. The biggest goodie in the goodie bag is a sweeping extension of liability protections in the airline stabilization package, the $15 billion bailout. There were liability protections in there for American and United Airlines, because those were, of course, the jetliners that crashed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Well, this new extension in the aviation security bill would extend that liability to Boeing, the folks that made the planes, people like General Electric who made the engines on the plane. It would extend to New York Port Authority, who are the owners of the World Trade Center.
These would all be protected from liability?
Protected from lawsuits stemming from damages requested from the attacks on September 11th.
There's a sense that some amount of political ideology might have been pushed aside on September 11th, but here it is, just as big and present as it could possibly be. Are observers in Washington expressing surprise that the Republicans would make such an ideological issue, even in light of the terrorist attacks on this point?
On a broad range of issues, partisanship has certainly been breaking down over the last couple of weeks. I mean, look at that economic stimulus package that passed by a squeaker. And it's looking like the same thing here.
So whichever way it goes, there will be sky marshals, there will be more strongly fortified cockpits, yes, and other security measures.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about this is the two sides. You have the bipartisan group, mostly Democrats, but a number of Republicans who support the Senate bill, and the White House-backed House Republican bill. They're about 90% similar. And until this morning and last night when they added some of these liability protections and other provisions. But on the merits of the security procedures in both bills, they're almost identical.
So it's all about whether they'll be federal employees or not.
That is the huge sticking point, yes.
And what time do you expect the vote, Peter?
They're saying around 8 o'clock, but you really never know around here. There's all kinds of things that could hold things up, but I'm fairly certain we should have a final vote no later than 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock, I'm expecting sometime in the 8 o'clock area.
Peter Cohn covers transportation for the Congressional Quarterly. I spoke to him earlier today from the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. President Bush said he's looked into the soul of Russian President Vladimir Putin and seen a good man. It's a new age of cooperation, now turbocharged by the war on terrorism. Are you comfortable with Washington's new wartime embrace of Moscow? Are you ready to see President Bush and Russian President Putin change the face of arms control in the rush of the war on terrorism? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Marshall Goldman. Marshall Goldman is Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard and Professor of Economics at Wellesley College. He's completing a new book right now called The Piratization of Russia. Welcome, Marshall Goldman.
Thanks.
Thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Also joining us from the studios of Sweet Spot Digital in Vermont is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Marshall Goldman, we just have a couple of minutes before the first break, but we see this astonishing evolution of the relationship between the Bush administration and Moscow. Donald Rumsfeld is leaving tomorrow for Moscow, where he is reportedly going to be trying to work out details of some breakthrough agreement on the ABM treaty and some dismantling of that. I think he himself would like to see it entirely dismantled. What's been the arc of the Bush administration's relationship with Moscow, starting in the campaign and coming right up to date through 9/11?
You go back to last year, just about a year ago, when the campaign was in full swing. The Bush campaign group, including Condoleezza Rice, who was his advisor then and now, was very critical of the way the Clinton administration had handled Yeltsin and then the Putin administrations, saying, well, we're not going to be so sympathetic. We want them to perform as a normal country. We expect them to be honest. And we don't like the way they're conducting the arms control process. That tone and that note continued for the first half of this year. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, President Bush and the advisors, the hardline advisors, are saying, well, now maybe we have to meet with Putin after President Bush said we won't meet until we get to Genoa, the G8 meeting, but he meets with him beforehand. And now they've had three meetings, and suddenly they're talking about, as you pointed out, looking at each other's souls, inviting him to the ranch and becoming very close friends.
And next up on the agenda seems doing something about the ABM treaty that would let George Bush go ahead with testing a new U.S. missile shield. It's been very controversial. It has roots that go all the way back to the Reagan era. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We're looking at the rapid evolution of the U.S.-Russia relationship, now more rapid than ever in their embrace in the war on terrorism. Are you comfortable with this new closeness between Washington and Moscow? And what do you think about its potential impact on the entire framework of nuclear arms control? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Scrapping the ABM treaty has long been at the top of President Bush's agenda, and after the September 11th attacks, he stepped up the campaign.
I have told Mr. Putin that the ABM treaty is outdated, antiquated, and useless, and I hope that he will join us in a new strategic relationship.
We're joined this evening by Marshall Goldman, Associate Director of the Davis Center at the for Russian Studies at Harvard and Professor of Economics at Wellesley College, by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty, and now by Andrew Weiss. Andrew Weiss is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and former Director for Russia, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council from 1998 to this past January, mostly under the Clinton administration. We're talking about the new embrace of Washington and Moscow, the many effects of that, and its potential impact on nuclear arms control. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew Weiss, just before the break, Marshall Goldman was describing for us this remarkable arc in the relationship of the Bush administration and Moscow from a fairly frosty posture during the campaign to now quite a warm embrace. And at the top of the agenda we see with Donald Rumsfeld headed to Moscow tomorrow, the ABM treaty and taking it apart to some extent. What is Rumsfeld going to be proposing?
I think actually at the top of the agenda is the war on terrorism. And I think the Bush administration is to be commended for knowing first things first. It's clear that Donald Rumsfeld is no fan of the ABM treaty, and he's going to be trying to put pressure on the Russians to essentially sign off on the United States walking away from the treaty. However, I think that when we see the two presidents meeting in Crawford in a couple weeks, we're more likely to see an elaborate fudge where the Russians sign up to more aggressive U.S. testing, which wouldn't be allowed under a strict interpretation of the treaty, but not a U.S. decision to shelve the treaty entirely. I think that kind of step in the atmosphere we're in, the United States essentially walking away from an important international agreement, would sour the mood in the international coalition against terrorism, and I don't think the administration aims to do that.
We read that there's been some tension between Condoleezza Rice and Don Rumsfeld on exactly this point, that Condoleezza Rice is more comfortable with simply, as you say, fudging the agreement to allow for testing, but that this goal of getting the test of the nuclear missile shield up and running is held by all parties in the administration, it seems.
Well, I think it's not necessarily the case, because when the president met most recently with Putin, his aides were essentially asking him to give Putin a deadline and to say that within the next 6 months, starting now, the United States intends to withdraw from the treaty, and in the end of that six-month period, the treaty will be null and void. The president balked at doing that, despite the best and most intense efforts of people like Donald Rumsfeld. So I think at this point, President Bush is keeping his own counsel, and I think that people who are advising him to take steps that are going to just inflame Russian sensitivities are going to find a tough sell. And I think that people are going to say, we've got really high stakes in the war in Afghanistan. We can't afford to sour this relationship at a tense moment like this.
Marshall Goldman, both sides in this newly warmed relationship have a laundry list of things that they'd like each from the other. What's on Washington's list and what's on Moscow's list?
Well, I think, as you've just heard, the main thing that we're interested right now in Russia is to support us in Afghanistan and the war on terrorism, to help us with intelligence, to allow us to use overflight so that we can use the bases in Central Asia. You can't really get to those bases in Central Asia, Uzbekistan in particular, unless you fly over Russia, unless you're going to go through Iran or someplace else. The Russians, however, have another set of priorities. They want to continue the anti-ballistic missile treaty in force. They also want to reduce the number of missiles that are out there because theirs are collapsing and they want us to bring ours down. They're also hesitant about allowing the United States to expand NATO to include the Baltic states. They also presumably would want some more economic agreements and things. So they have their problems. And I should also say President Putin is getting some guff from his staff, including some of the generals, who feel that allowing the United States to go ahead with testing the missile, national missile defense thing, will embarrass and weaken Russia.
Jack Beatty, you've been watching all this from north of Boston. What do you see unfolding, particularly on the nuclear agreements front, but across the relationship?
Well, I you know, it's a moment of opportunity in the relationship, clearly. To me, the open question is, to what extent are the Russians basically accommodating themselves to what seemed the clear decision to do this and saying, well, here's a chance to cut our losses and to eliminate, to really cut down our stockpile and the of nuclear weapons and the expense attendant to maintaining that stockpile, or whether this represents something more. In other words, I don't quite see what the give is yet on our side, other than this fudge. And I was very disappointed when President Bush made that statement at the press conference that you quoted, that we quoted mm-hmm. earlier, because it seemed to be, as Mr. Weiss said, dissonant with the whole mood of the administration. And maybe they've moved from that now toward some kind of fudge. After all, saving face for Russia is also an important consideration, and perhaps this will help. And then also there's another issue here, and that is the de-alerting of these missiles. That is, these missiles now are on hair trigger alert, and President Bush said he was for that. Clinton was prevented from going ahead with that because the Republican Congress wouldn't let him. President Bush says he's for it. Now, that could be a significant breakthrough in terms of the stability of the current offensive balance. That is to say, if we can agree with them to de-alert the missiles, that's a much more secure situation. Whether that can go along with missile defense or not, I don't know. But that was part of Bush's original idea.
Andrew Weiss, if you would, walk us through the basics of each side's interests in this nuclear conversation. We're talking about cuts in the number of missiles. We're talking about de-alerting. We're talking about the ABM treaty. What does each side bring to the table?
Well, I think the key concern for the Russians is that they see their nuclear arsenal as their final claim on quasi-superpower status internationally, and that if the United States is able to build a set of missile defenses, not very ambitious at the beginning, but potentially ambitious over time, there is a danger that the Russian deterrent, their ability to hold our country at risk in the event of some sort of unexpected rise in tensions and possible confrontation between the United States and Russia, their ability to do that would be gone. And what they want, essentially, is to ensure that there is no ability for the United States to build unrestrained missile defenses, which could threaten their ability to blow up the United States in a crisis. The United States, on the other hand, I think, doesn't see Russia as and the confrontation with Russia as the main concern, but rather rogue states and terrorists and others getting their hands on advanced missile technology, and they believe that they can build up a set of missile defenses that won't threaten Russia's deterrent, that there would always be a Russian ability to overwhelm any missile defense that we build. I think the problem for the Russians is that their nuclear arsenal is just coming down because of economic factors. It's expensive to maintain, and the resulting economic pressures on them mean that there's a natural downward trajectory they're on. So they would like to codify that trajectory in a lower threshold for U.S. and Russian nuclear forces. The administration looks at that and goes, well, okay, but, you know, there are a range of things that we need to retain our nuclear capability to guard against. We're not just worried about Russia. We're worried about China. We're worried about other countries like North Korea. And the United States is going to be, I think, still quite reluctant, especially the generals at the Pentagon, to go as low as President Putin would like, which is approximately 1,500 or below.
Admiral Richard Meese, commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, has argued vociferously against, it seems, almost any cuts. Is that right?
No, there was an agreement in 1995 between Presidents Clinton and Yeltsin to go down roughly in the neighborhood of 2,250 to 2,500. And the United States and Russia are presumably going to go in that direction and codify it in a new agreement. The question is, would you go for deeper cuts? And I think this is the kind of issue where the president's going to have to break a lot of eggs at the Pentagon to persuade people to go lower. And at this point, when we're fighting a war and there's a lot of uncertainty about the kind of strategic environment, mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a hard sell.
Why is the Pentagon reluctant to go below a 2,000-some missiles?
They build all sorts of scenarios, and they build them on a worst-case basis. I'm not saying I endorse their view, mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert on the kind of targeting decisions they have to make, but I think the main concern that any military leader is going to have is uncertainty, and you want to ensure that you have enough redundancy in your arsenal so that if everything goes wrong, you're still able to ensure that any country that threatens the United States knows that it will have a huge price to pay if it does that. And I think the generals are going to say, look, we're in the middle of a war. You're asking us to turn decades of U.S. strategic thinking on its ear. Let's go down to the limits that were agreed by President Clinton and President Yeltsin. or perhaps a little bit below that, but let's not buy the Russian proposal to go all the way down to the 1,500 neighborhood.
Marshall Goldman, you've been watching this relationship for a long time. You know Russia inside extremely well. What do you see coming out of this new embrace? What strengths and what strangeness, I guess, in some ways? There's a kind of embrace here we haven't seen before, and we seem willing to deal with Moscow on a whole lot of levels that we might not have been open to before September 11th.
Well, this new opening gives us a chance to do a lot of things, and it gives the Russians a chance to do a lot of things that presumably they wanted to do anyway. But it would have been a loss of face or whatever you might describe it. For example, Putin has just announced unilaterally that he's withdrawing, closing down this listening base that he has, intelligence base that he has in Cuba, and also the naval base that exists in Vietnam. Now, he's doing this for a variety of reasons. One, because it's been costly. Two, because the Cold War is over. And what does he need to listen into the United States for, except probably for commercial information now? But he did that. He also talking, as Mr. Weiss just mentioned, about the effort to cut back the number of missiles that exist to 1,500 or thereabouts, largely, again, to save money. But this, again, isn't a chance to do it, and maybe the United States will accommodate him. I think one of the things that's interesting here is that both sides, you know, Bush and Putin, do seem to recognize that some of the most important aspects of the Cold War are over, and it's time to redesign your military posture. We've been talking about that. Rumsfeld was supposed to have brought through a new set of proposals, but Putin is doing the same thing, and he is more has more economic pressures on him to do this, and so getting rid of the base in Cuba, firing the Minister of Defense, who was a big proponent of missiles, and talking about strike forces, the kind of thing we're talking about, just gives both sides a chance to do something this way, and it may, in the process, lower the nuclear tension.
Hang on. We've got callers who want to join the conversation. I'm going to bring them in now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the new texture of the relationship between Washington and Moscow in the context of the war on terrorism. 1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Excellent. I'm very scared about Bush and Putin getting together because I feel like it's incredibly Orwellian. You know, it reminds me of 1984 with Rumsfeld as Big Brother. And more so, a missile defense wouldn't have stopped any terrorist action at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. And I think that we're going to overlook Putin's offenses in Chechnya in this endeavor as our countries get closer.
Mm. We take your concern, Dan. Thanks for your call. Marshall Goldman, let me just put that to you. I know we can't keep you for long here, but you've talked about George Bush looking into Putin's eyes and seeing a good man, and Dan seems to be in part responding and maybe not fully accepting that here.
Well, I would agree with Dan. I mean, you know, you look into Putin's eyes, and what you're going to see is a pretty messy situation there because he was a field officer in the KGB. He's led this really very bloody battle in Chechnya, which we are now prepared to soft soap a little bit. But more than that, there is much more presence in Russia today of the KGB, or the FSB as it's called now. And he's done a lot of things, including closing down any press media that criticize him, or at least moving that way in television. The newspapers are still pretty active, but he's shrinking it. And so we're moving this way. But again, you know, it's like World War II, the meeting between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Uncle Joe Stalin. Well, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, we suddenly said, well, that ally is more important to us, the Soviets are more important to us, and we'll overlook some of their problems or many of their problems simply because Hitler and the Japanese right now are bigger threats.
Mm. Marshall Goldman, always good talking with you. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Marshall Goldman is Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard and a Professor of Economics at Wellesley College. We're talking about the U.S.-Russia relationship in the context of the war on terrorism. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Russ is on the line. Welcome, Russ.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, with regards to the question as to whether it's a good idea that world leaders are actually talking with each other, I think that's quite obvious. It's a good idea for these people to talk to each other. With regard to the question of the direction they're going in, I'm with Dan. I'm quite concerned about the notion that the focus is still on prevention of attack via missile and high tech, which is not what's happening. And I'm just trying to imagine the initiative where the money that would go and the brain power that would go into Star Wars would instead go into thinking about how to get inside terrorist cells and deeper, how to create societies and cultures and support the development of those so that it's simply not possible that people would conceive of destroying millions of lives.
Right. Russ, thanks for your call. Let's put it to Andrew Weiss. I guess part of the question that's raised here, Andrew Weiss, is why are we talking about nuclear missile shields when the threats seem much more on the ground? It's box cutters, it's hijacked planes, it's terrorism.
Well, I think that for the Republican administration, missile defense is an ideological matter of faith. I think that there's a lot of skepticism. I think that people share your listeners' view that there are more immediate and pressing things. People are much more likely to drive a missile into New York Harbor on a boat than they are to fly it in on a missile. And I think that the administration, though, has, under Rumsfeld's leadership over the last several years, hardened its view that this is a clear and present danger. And Rumsfeld himself chaired a commission that was set up by the Congress to look at the nature of ballistic missile threats against the United States and has come back with a very forward-leaning position that missile threat is impending and we need to get moving on building defenses to guard against it. But I think that the position is exactly right, that there are these immediate threats, particularly in the terrorist realm, and we need to be looking at ways to cooperate with the Russians to build on the goodwill that's been created in the past month and to make practical and tangible progress on defeating our terrorist enemies. I don't think that this is the time for the administration to be squandering that goodwill and essentially poking a finger in the Russian eye and saying that, you know, you're powerless to stop us. We're going to build this missile defense, and we're going to expect your cooperation on terrorism regardless.
Yeah.
Tom,
if I may add a word.
This study that Mr. Weiss talks about, I mean, it really began in the 1996 campaign when Bob Dole made Star Wars, scaled down for post-Soviet threat, a, quote, top defense priority. And then the CIA reported in 1995 that that missile threats from any of these rogue states, North Korea, Iran, and so on, was at least 15 years away. And then the defense hawks said, no, we got to have another study. So then the CIA did another study, this one under Robert Gates, which said, well, still 15 years away. Then Newt Gingrich took the initiative in appointing this Rumsfeld commission that said, no, it's much closer than we thought. And that this whole picture of the threat that to which the missile shield is supposed to be answering, some people think is extraordinarily tenuous and a sort of a real artifact of sort of pre-September 11th thinking about where security lies.
We're talking about the U.S.-Russia relationship in the context of the war on terrorism and how the whole nuclear posture fits in. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the U.S.-Russia embrace in the midst of the war on terrorism and its many, many implications, including its implications for conversations about nuclear arms agreement and control. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined this hour by Andrew Weiss. He's a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and former director for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council from 1998 until this January, and by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Gary is on the line right now. Welcome, Gary. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to talk about missile defense and the ABM Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ABM Treaty and the treaties that preceded and followed it have provided some stability in a very dangerous nuclear world. For 50 years now, we've had treaties that have managed to keep the lid on real nuclear war. What is happening now is that in the name of missile defense, the administration is ready to scrap the ABM Treaty and thereby really undercut the START treaties and the SALT agreements and leave us in a much more dangerous place. But furthermore, missile defense doesn't exist. And most scientists, like myself, would tell you that it's unworkable. So what we have here is a kind of shibboleth of the Reagan Republicans and a phantom in reality.
Gary, let me put it to Andrew Weiss. Andrew Weiss, are we seeing here, there's always been this debate about missile defense, Star Wars plan. Are we seeing here that in the fog of war, war on terrorism, it's somehow being pushed through? Is there any more clarity? Is there any more belief that this can be effective today than there was 5 years ago, 15 years ago?
Well, no. I think the administration has a very steep uphill battle in front of it to try and prove to the world and prove to itself that this new kind of technology actually works. And the administration has launched a pretty ambitious schedule of tests of various components for a system. And the danger of those tests is, in fact, that several of them, including one that was scheduled for later this month, would actually violate the treaty, and that the form and content of those tests are not permissible under the current treaty. So I think what we're up against is an attempt by certain people who want to promote the end of the ABM treaty to have an ambitious testing set of tests precisely to drive a truck through the treaty. But again, the technology is not proven. I think that there's a lot to be gained from continuing this type of research, and I think that if the technology were available, no American president would be able to really, if it were affordable, to stand back and say, I don't want to do this. I think that the threat of rogue states getting missiles is real. I think we know that the North Koreans and that the Iraqis and that the Iranians and other people are quite interested in these kinds of technologies. And so for the United States to essentially put its head in the sand is not an option. But for the United States also to essentially top-load a decision on missile defense, I think, would be inappropriate so long as the technology is not proven and that the kind of the China you're going to break, like the relationship with the Russians or the Chinese in the middle of a war, I think that those kinds of relationships outweigh the need to move forward on deploying a missile defense.
But Jack, yes, you hear the concern that Gary's raising here, and we've all heard it before. Is the political calculus changed by the war on terrorism, or is it just Bush, as Andrew Weiss says, driving the truck through?
Well, it's Don Rumsfeld doing it, too. I mean, his hostility to arms control is well known. When he was in his first tour as defense secretary, he did all he could to undermine the SALT agreements with the Soviet Union, SALT I with the Soviet Union, SALT II, rather. And Henry Kissinger basically said, well, we just can't go any further. And then after he finished being defense secretary, the CIA came out with a report that said the Soviet threat is not as grave as we thought, and therefore we don't have to spend as much as we should, or some people want us to, on defense. And Rumsfeld lobbied George Bush Sr., who was then the director of the CIA, to appoint another committee called Team B, which came out with a very dark analysis of Soviet capabilities that, of course, we have since realized was completely fictitious. But that Team B business and that view of the Soviet Union as this great threat really helped to undermine arms control in the Carter administration. So Don Rumsfeld is against arms control. And that's been his career mission. He sees the world as a much more dangerous place than his own CIA sees it. He sees Russia as more dangerous. He saw the Soviet Union as more dangerous. And today he sees rogue states, which the CIA says, well, they're a threat 15 years down the way. He sees them as much more serious threats.
And, of course, the Secretary of Defense has more sway during a war than any other time, and we are now in a war.
Indeed.
We're at 1-800-423-8255 talking about the new relationship between Washington and Moscow in the war on terrorism. You can join the conversation. John is on the line right now. John, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello. Yes.
Yeah. I think you're setting up a false choice here, or several of your guests and callers are, between fighting terrorists with box cutters and fighting rogue states with missiles. I think both are threats, and we should try and do both. And I think if the last couple months have taught us anything, it's that if we can imagine some form of destruction, someone else can probably imagine it and we'll try and go do it. And that we should, you know, whether it's 15 years away or 5 years away, no one can say with certainty which, how far away that threat is. We can say with certainty that at least it's a threat. We should certainly take the time and the effort to defend ourselves against that threat.
John, that certainly seems to be what Donald Rumsfeld is arguing. And Andrew Weiss, I think that I hear you saying the same thing, that we really don't have a choice, in your view, but to look at both of these kinds of levels of threat.
Absolutely. I think it would be irresponsible for an administration to not look at this kind of technology. The real question, though, is do you take steps right now in the middle of a war that are going to threaten the cooperation of important countries like Russia and China? And I think that, you know, before people jump to conclusions, that Don Rumsfeld's views on this are obviously extreme, and I just think it's important for people not to jump to the conclusion that his views are going to win out in the debate that is being held at the highest levels in Washington. I think that President Bush and others around him recognize full well that this may not be an opportune moment to junk the ABM treaty. We saw the hue and cry that was created when the United States walked away from the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, and I think people are quite scarred by that experience. And so I think for your listeners, it's important not to jump to the conclusion that this is a done deal.
But do you see that, in fact, or don't see, that Putin may, in fact, be somehow open to this right now? There's a sense of malleability that seems to be coming from Moscow, or do I misread?
I think there's a greater openness to finding a fudge. I don't think there's an openness for him to sign off on what's being described as the Rumsfeld variant here, which is the ABM treaty goes away and, you know, arms control as we know it is gone. I think the Russians have a lot of leverage and can say, you know, with a straight face that, look, we want to find a way that helps you develop this technology. We see that there are a range of new threats, and I think the Russians acknowledge that. And it's best that we work on these things in a way that's not provocative, that doesn't undermine the stability that was generated by the end of the Cold War. So I think the Russians at this point have to juxtapose that position with the fact that they don't have a tremendous amount of leverage and that their leverage comes primarily from weakness. So that for the Russians to throw themselves in front of the train here and then fail, there would probably be greater political damage to someone like Putin than for him to try to work out an elaborate balancing act with the Bush administration.
Andrew Weiss, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Great to be here. Thanks again.
Andrew Weiss is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and was with the Clinton administration's Russia team on the National Security Council from 1998 until January. Thanks very much, Andrew Weiss. Jack Beatty, you see the range laid out there. We're clearly cooperating in very tangible, on-the-ground ways with Russia around the war now in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and then all the way to this very high-level conversation about the at some points, esoteric calculus of nuclear weaponry and warfare.
Yeah, Dan Shore on NPR earlier this evening said that, you know, we've sort of turned a new leaf. The line in foreign policy used to be between communism and democracy. Well, now it's between the countries that are against it's a line drawn by terror. And Russia is getting on that side of the line, although it practices a kind of state terrorism in Chechnya with massive reprisals and leveling a city and so on. There's a new page now, and Russia clearly wants to be on our side, on the side of the people against terror.
And the kind of complaints that a Republican administration and a conservative one might have made just a year ago, we are not hearing.
No. No. Priority has, you know, the terror has taken priority over everything else. But this pathway, even fudging this business with the ABM treaty, it has other implications on other relationships. The Chinese have said they're going to increase their missiles tenfold if we go ahead with any kind of missile defense. So
much
it
more
has
to
all
come.
Kinds of. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you, Jack. You
Thank
can
you.
Continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, the struggle to plan a future when the present has been turned upside down. Jennifer Claire Scott worked as an event planner at the top of the World Observation Deck at the World Trade Center. She says the list of things that haven't changed in her life since September 11th is all too short.
How has my life changed since September 11th? It's probably easier for me to answer the question, how hasn't my life changed? In a matter of minutes, I lost friends, colleagues, my place of work, my sense of safety and security, even my compass point for finding my way around the city. It just took minutes, but the changes will last forever. It's been a month and a half now. In some ways, it seems like a lifetime. In other ways, a fleeting moment. I don't cry every day anymore. But little things, a song or a photograph in the newspaper, sometimes bring unexpected tears. Most of the time, it is just sadness, sometimes overwhelming. It's difficult to imagine being happy again. But despite the sadness, my life has to go on. The way I see it, I have two choices. I can stop and hide, or I can get out of bed every morning and keep moving forward. And I choose to move forward, no matter how hard that might be. Moving forward means getting a new job. And getting a new job means facing several realities. Top of the world is gone. The hospitality and tourism industry in New York City just bottomed out. Companies aren't hiring event planners. If anything, event planners are being let go. So on top of everything, I've had to accept that I might not be doing exactly what I want, and it might mean moving. Last week, I accepted a job as a special events manager at the Meadowlands. Never would I have imagined myself working at a racetrack. But I'm going to make the best of it. It will mean, however, moving to New Jersey. And moving to New Jersey is going to mean starting all over again, finding my way around, locating the great bagel place, the best dry cleaners, making new friends in my building and neighborhood. And I am really worried about losing touch with my friends here in the city. These are people who have kept me going with their caring and kindness over the last few weeks. Keeping in touch with friends and family, and really letting them know how important to me they are, has taken on a heightened importance in my life generally. I've lost enough friends recently. I can't handle losing any more. The big changes I can deal with. They're logical. They're necessary. The harder things to handle are the little ones. The sounds of sirens and jet engines terrify me. I hold my breath and listen and wait every time I hear one. If I see an airplane in the sky, I watch it to see where it goes. Watching the news has become completely overwhelming. I never know when they are going to show footage of that day, or interview a survivor, or show yet another memorial that took place in the city. All that does is make me cry and remind me of the horror. And if they aren't talking about Ground Zero, they are talking about Operation Enduring Freedom, or anthrax, or smallpox. I'm still trying to deal with September 11th. So I just don't watch the news anymore. Countless times since September 11th, I've been asked, "How are you?" A month and a half after the tragedy, and I still have no idea how to answer that question. How am I? I'm alive. But I still fight feelings of guilt every day. I worked on the top floor of Tower 2. If I hadn't been running late, I would have been there, and probably would have been with the five others from our staff that didn't make it out. Instead, I was less than two blocks away when I heard the sound of the jet engines over my head, and I stood there in the shade of an airplane and watched it just miss the tops of the other buildings and fly straight into the place where I work. The horrible things that I saw and heard and smelled and felt that day are burned into my memory. I will be haunted by them. But I am alive, and as long as I keep getting out of bed every day, I'm going to be okay. So, how has my life changed? Getting out of bed has become a big deal.
Jennifer Claire Scott is a special events planner for the Meadowlands in Secaucus, New Jersey. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Listening to...